My name is Aaron Mace, manager of the Hackley and Hume Historic Site, and today I'll be talking about the Great Depression and its effects, both positive and negative, on Muskegon. Our historic sites include the Skolnick House of the Depression Era, a unique hands-on house museum set in the era of the 1930s. Open from May to October, this immersive museum offers the chance to step back in time and experience what life was really like during the Great Depression. Of course, to talk about the Great Depression of the 1930s, we first have to talk about its origins in the stock market crash of 1929. The growing economy of the Roaring Twenties led to a large increase in the stock market. As the actual economy began to slow down in the summer of 1929 for a variety of reasons, including low wages, an increase in unemployment, and consumer debt, stock prices continued to rise higher than their actual worth. Stock prices then began to fall in September and October, and with Black Thursday on October 24th and Black Tuesday on October 29th, investors sold stocks in a hurry, causing the entire stock market to crash. This stock market crash significantly lowered consumer confidence, which in turn lowered levels of production. These lower levels of production meant lower levels of employment. As production was cut, companies laid off employees, and thus the stage was set for the Great Depression to begin. As happened in many places, the effects of the Great Depression on Muskegon were profound. At the start of 1929, the Muskegon Chamber of Commerce wrote, "The year 1929 promises to be Muskegon's miracle year. Never before in Muskegon history, not even during the hectic war years, has this city made such rapid progress. Through the expansion of local plants and the addition of new plants coming here from outside, factory employment will increase 10 to 15%. In July of 1929, Muskegon's population of around 41,000 had approximately 18,000 employed wage earners. However, after the stock market crash in October, December's numbers dropped to around 12,000 employed wage earners. Many local organizations gave relief to those without jobs. The Red Cross, Salvation Army, and Muskegon Rescue Mission provided support. The Muskegon Rescue Mission gave out 600 meals a day, provided sleeping accommodations for 125 men, and ran a boarding house for African-American workers in Muskegon Heights. The city itself tried to provide relief, but was bankrupt by 1932 and couldn't even pay city employees. Local businessman L.C. Walker tried to combat low employment by embracing the Share the Work movement. Some sources say he invented the Share the Work movement, but this remains uncertain. This movement proposed that instead of laying off workers, businesses should only operate their plants 3 days a week until the demand for their products increased to a normal level. This policy was adopted by over 40 local businesses, and Walker's promotion of this idea led him to be appointed vice chairman of the National Share the Work Committee. This plan had a number of pros, such as lower unemployment rates, less strain on the welfare system, lowering the fear and stress of unemployment itself, and higher morale among workers. However, it did have its downsides as well. Workers were only paid part-time wages and saw no increase in their individual purchasing power. It also took away full-time work from those more qualified, and even full-time pay was often inadequate to live on during the Depression. In order to combat the effects of the Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt announced the New Deal. On March 5, 1933, 1 day after his inauguration, President Roosevelt declared a 4-day bank holiday in order to stop withdrawals and stabilize banks. Congress also passed the Emergency Banking Act, which closed insolvent banks and reorganized those still viable. In his first fireside chat, Roosevelt urged Americans to put their money back into the banking system. This worked, and by the end of the month, 3/4 of banks had reopened. The Glass-Steagall Act, also passed in 1933, prohibited banks from participating in the investment market. In May, Congress passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, a bill to pay farmers to stop farming in order to raise prices and limit excess product. The National Industrial Recovery Act gave workers the right to unionize and collectively bargain for better wages and working conditions. 14 other laws were passed by Congress, all with the aim of stimulating the economy and protecting workers. The establishment of the Civilian Conservation Corps had a direct impact on Muskegon. CCC Camp 676 was based in Muskegon and was located where the lodge of the Muskegon Luge Adventure Sports Park is today. The Muskegon CCC helped establish Muskegon State Park and built the original blockhouse in 1934. The CCC also graded the extension of Scenic Drive all the way to the Muskegon Lake Channel. FDR announced the Second New Deal in the spring of 1935. While the New Deal took steps to counteract the economic depression, conditions remained poor, so a set of more aggressive steps were taken. The Second New Deal began with the creation of the WPA, or Works Progress Association. The sole purpose of the WPA was to increase employment, as the unemployment rate in 1935 was still at 20%. WPA projects were not allowed to compete with private businesses, so its focus was mainly on bridges, parks, highways, schools, and post offices. The WPA also included Federal Project No. 1, which employed actors, musicians, artists, and writers. By the end of 1939, the WPA employed 8.8 million Americans. During this time, the WPA built 4,000 schools, 130 hospitals, paved and repaired 280,000 miles of roads, and planted 24 million trees. The WPA in Muskegon also made a significant impact. The WPA played a large role in the start of the Muskegon County Museum, today known as the Lakeshore Museum Center. The WPA also helped with other public projects, such as the creation of the Veterans Memorial Park along the causeway, which was completed in 1934. The investment by the federal government in Muskegon during the first few years of the Depression was truly monumental, totaling around $4.6 million. Today, it would be the equivalent of about $105 million. The motto, "Use it up, wear it out, make do, or do without," embodied much of the general feeling about life during the Great Depression. Across the country, people did what they could to make their belongings last and maintain their standard of living. To cut expenses and save the family home, people often rented a portion to another family. Based on apartments listed in Muskegon classified ads from the 1930s, a furnished apartment with a separate entrance would probably cost between $10 and $12 a month. This was relatively low, as the majority of renters in the U.S. in the 1930s paid at least $15 or more per month. Relatives or friends down on their luck may have moved into an already crowded house. Because the once large family home had to be divided, a single bedroom might accommodate several members of the family. These housing changes and overall economic upheaval led to a decline in birth and divorce rates for the first time in our nation's history. Food was also a family's largest expense behind rent. Families would often keep a vegetable garden in their backyard or side yard to provide extra food, which could be eaten fresh or canned. Chickens were also an easy way to increase a household's food. Their eggs could be used and sold, and the chickens themselves could eventually become a Sunday dinner. The federal government began providing funding for community garden efforts in 1934, and in 1 year's time produced $47 million worth of food and fed over 2 million families. While federal funding for the garden programs ended in 1935, many communities continued these efforts. Many recipes during the Great Depression reflect an emphasis on nourishment rather than tasting good. The Bureau of Home Economics published numerous recipe books throughout the 1930s to help families create simple meals and save money. Some examples of this decade's not-so-appetizing recipes are the ribbon or black and white sandwich, comprised of alternating pieces of white and wheat bread with butter, a peanut butter stuffed onion, and green tomato pie, sliced green tomatoes tossed in sugar and apple pie spices like cinnamon and nutmeg. The 1930s also saw the birth of many brands we still know today. Fremont, Michigan's own Gerber introduced the first commercially available baby food in 1931. Twinkies also appeared in 1931 with their original banana filling. And two other American staples, Kraft mac and cheese and Lay's potato chips, appeared in 1937 and 1939, respectively. The end of Prohibition was another major change. Michigan became the first state to ratify the 21st Amendment, which appealed Prohibition. Beer with 3.2% alcohol was served again at 6 p.m. on May 11, 1933, at the going price of 20 cents. Many places around the state ran out of beer, and rush shipments had to be brought in. Although, according to the Muskegon Chronicle, beer made an orderly return in the city of Muskegon, and police only reported one related arrest that night. In the world of transportation, automobiles continued to dominate. By 1929, there were 27 million cars in the United States, which was enough for one per every household. Railroads declined in popularity as cars became more common, highway systems improved, and air travel became more efficient. The economic effects of the Great Depression and popularity of cars also wiped out more interurban lines. While flying was around in the 1920s, major changes took place which made it more popular in the 30s. The rise of monoplanes allowed for faster travel and therefore made flying more appealing. In 1930, only 6,000 Americans traveled commercially. However, by 1938, 1.2 million Americans traveled by air. Amelia Earhart herself visited the newly completed Muskegon Airport in September of 1931. Leisure activities also began to change in the 1930s, with movies becoming increasingly popular. With the introduction of sound into films with The Jazz Singer in 1927, the 1930s saw the start of the golden age of cinema, with films such as Dracula in 1931, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in 1937, and Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, both released in 1939. It cost 15 cents to go to the movies at Muskegon State and Regent Theaters, while The Strand in Muskegon Heights cost a quarter. Despite the cost, between 60 and 75 million movie tickets were sold every week in the 1930s out of a U.S. population of 127 million. The Michigan Theater, today known as the Frauenthal, opened its doors in September of 1930. The 1930s was also the golden age of radio, and by 1939, 80% of the U.S. population had a radio. The popular music of the day included swing-style jazz, country, and classical. And radio shows were also popular. One famous example is a War of the Worlds radio broadcast by Orson Welles in 1938, which caused some people to believe that Martians had actually invaded and were taking over the Earth. Variety shows, sports, and news broadcasts, along with President Roosevelt's fireside chats, kept people entertained and listening. One of the most enduring images of the Great Depression is the hobo. Traveling from place to place, hobos crossed the country in search of work and food. Riding the rails was a huge part of the lifestyle of hobos. Between 1929 and 1941, 4 million Americans traveled across the country looking for work and food. And of that 4 million, 250,000 were teenagers. In easy situations, hobos could walk up and gain access to a train with no hassle. However, many trains were monitored, so hobos had to wait and nail the train. This meant jumping on the train as it was already in motion, which could be extremely dangerous. There were different ways that one had to ride depending on the train. On a passenger train, a hobo would probably have to ride blind, as they would say, meaning riding in the space between the passenger car and the locomotive. Riding blind could be especially dangerous, as falling asleep, losing balance, freezing to death due to exposure, and being hit by hot coals were all real possibilities. In other situations, a hobo could ride on the top deck. This meant riding on the top of the train to avoid detection. This also had dangers from high winds, blowing soot and ash, and overhead obstacles. Riding inside a boxcar could also be dangerous depending on the cargo. If the cargo were to shift inside the car, a hobo could be hurt or killed. Riding in an empty boxcar was certainly ideal, but not exactly easy. In the summertime, boxcars became extremely hot, and in the winter, they were freezing cold. Hobos would often scrounge materials from the cars themselves and start a small fire to stay warm in cold months. Riding the railroad had a cost for many hobos. In 1932 alone, 2,791 trespassers were injured trying to board trains, and 1,886 were killed. Hobos developed their own language and symbols to communicate. Many slang terms we use today were invented by hobos, such as a main drag for a busy road in a town, a moniker meaning a nickname, and moochers being professional beggars. Hobo signs or marks drawn on the outside of buildings, fences, or bridges were also a vital way in which hobos could communicate with one another about the availability of food, lodgings, or whether they might be in danger. Since many hobos had limited education, symbols were easier to learn and read than actual words. Hobos often congregated in hobo jungles, these being places for hobos to gather together and share food, water, and a fire for warmth. hobo jungles were usually on the outskirts of a city or town to not raise suspicion or notice from the police, and also near railroads for easy access. A hobo jungle would usually have kitchen utensils, pots and pans for cooking, a clothesline, and a mirror for shaving. Each day, hobos were expected to find fuel for the communal fire and contribute ingredients for their improvised mulligan stew. When the hobos left the jungle, they were expected to clean up and leave things in order for the next group of hobos. Another signature characteristic of the Great Depression is the shanty town, also known as a Hooverville. Shanty towns had long existed in America, but their frequency exploded due to the conditions of the Great Depression. The term Hooverville first appeared in 1930 and was derived from the name of President Herbert Hoover, whom many blamed for the conditions of the Great Depression. By 1933, 15 million Americans, or one quarter of U.S. workers, were unemployed. As families lost their jobs and homes, they gathered with others to form small communities and used found materials, such as wood, tar paper, cardboard, glass, and tin, to construct new homes and form Hooverville settlements. First-hand accounts provide grim details about living in shanty towns. Hooverville stew was a common meal for many families, and this makeshift meal often comprised of macaroni, canned tomatoes, hot dogs, and beans or corn. With no proper bathroom facilities, people often relieved themselves in the small areas between the shanties. Alcoholism was not only common among men, but Hoovervilles would also sometimes have their own brewing and distilling operations. Violence and crime were also very real dangers. Despite these shortcomings, Hooverville residents formed strong communities and banded together to help each other. Residents would often divide up federal relief funds amongst themselves. And when surveyed, many Hooverville residents preferred to stay where they were than to go elsewhere. During the Great Depression, two Hoovervilles existed just outside of downtown Muskegon and were known as the White City and Coney Island. Both were located at the mouth of the Muskegon River as it enters Muskegon Lake. This area near the lake made sense for Hoovervilles as it was close to fresh water and train tracks for hobos that might ride the rails. Like other Hoovervilles, they were frequently raided by police, and it was said that much of the bootleg whiskey and beer that flowed in Muskegon originated in the White City, although its quality was likely not improved by the dead rats found floating in the barrels. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.